The following content may be distressing. Listener discretion is advised. If you need to, contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
It doesn't bring me pleasure to give a first-hand account of my childhood. Having to wear jumpers on a 40-degree day one time, I cried, wanting to take it off, got hit for that, then sent to my room until my dad came home from work, got me out of it, and then he had to endure my mother's wrath, getting my stomach pumped because my mother gave me a jelly bean. Then forgot, thinking that I must have somehow gone into the garden and eaten some poisonous berry off a tree. All they found in my tummy was a jelly bean. Being told I was born to be my mother's best friend and cleaner because women clean, not the boys, and yet she's not keen on cleaning, cooking, working. Watching my mother try and throw herself out in front of a moving car when she wasn't getting her way with my dad. Watching her walk out and say she's going to sit in the road and get hit by a car because she wasn't getting her way with me or my dad. Disdain at any idea of me having a future besides serving her insatiable needs privately and giving up on life just like she has many years ago. I could go on. In my experience, I believe my mother is a narcissist and my father is an enabler. Danu Morrigan runs the website Daughters of Narcissistic Mothers and is the author of the book You're Not Crazy, It's Your Mother. Danu, most people never think of the possibility of narcissistic mothers because society elevates them as your everyday hero. On your website, you've said that it was to your detriment that you bought into society's lies, had to keep in touch with parents no matter how horrible they are to you. We're grateful that you're so strong to share your experience and knowledge. Sharing, not preaching, I think, is the best way to resonate with people in the situation, possibly unwilling to get out of it or maybe can't find a way to. But it's incredibly taxing to go through, relive. I also think worth it to help others and alter perceptions, bring to the forefront of people's minds that emotional abuse and narcissists aren't always your typical Kim Kardashians. This type of abuse is less talked about.
Emma, you're right. It's an invisible abuse, and in three ways, in fact. The narcissistic mother doesn't think she's abusing anybody because in her own mind she's perfect, so she wouldn't do anything like that. The victim doesn't feel like it's going on because they're told it's not going on, or they're told that they have a vivid imagination, or they're told, as you were, that it's their role to accept this, and they've nothing to compare it with. So they don't know what's going on. And then society, it's invisible to society because it's so nuanced and subtle, but also because society, as you say, has this narrative that mothers are perfect, to the extent that the only way as culture we could deal with this, the idea of mothers in fairy tales was to call them stepmothers. You know, that's why it's always wicked stepmothers, not mothers, because we can't bring ourselves to go there that mothers are or can be less than decent people.
So I was seen as a possession. In your instance, at least looking at your website, it's a similar account. Would you give us some sort of insight into the things that you had to endure to help people, you know, trigger in their mind, like, wait a minute, that happened to me too. I thought, you know, that was just how it was, as you said.
Yeah. My experiences, I think, I was horrified listening to yours. My experiences were not nearly as extreme as yours. But in a way, they were more difficult to get a handle on because of that, because they were more subtle. Mm. My mother would do things like, if she ever didn't get away, she would sulk and even cry. And her famous catchphrase, "Well, you've upset me now." And all useful dialogue would stop at that point. So she never had to deal with anything. But, you know, if you tried to get her to face up to something, she would instead of crying, and that was the end of it. She, her other phrase, but one with the pull right, "That's enough. I am not speaking of this. I'm your mother." And even well into my 40s, I'm embarrassed to admit it now, but that would have me quaking in my boots. She all denial, and she'd say kindly, "Oh, you have such a vivid imagination," when you were saying, you know, something happened. She said, "It didn't happen. You're making it up." And when we're trying to negotiate with her, to speak with her. But the abuse itself was things like, it came out most at big occasions, whether they were my successors and my boys. She just dismissed them. She hijacked them for her own purposes so she could talk to her friends about it. But she absolutely shut down any celebration on my behalf. And the other one were my bad times. And she made them all about her as well. I remember I miscarried my first baby and she was incandescent with excitement about it, like the drama and the fun and the, it was just, you know, horrific at a time when things are awful anyway. And it's just, you know, she was saying the right words, like, oh, it's awful. But she was kind of glowing. It was like she was a soap opera actress saying the lines, but not very well. And so, you know, I knew I could pick up. But again, I was doubting myself. I could pick up, hang on, this isn't right. You know, there's no genuine compassion or kindness here at all. But again, it was all I knew and I didn't have the words to explain it. Mm. So they were the kind of things that she would do.
We're similar in the sense that, or at least in our situations, narcissism isn't about, you know, grandiosity, not the Kim Kardashian vanity is global sense, but more her own personal bubble. So everything is about her, totally self-centered. Attention must be on her, demanding respect and obedience without earning it. Only interested in things that reflect well on her. No empathy, anyone's problems, tragedies, like you've just said, that horrific story then. And everything's got to be rounded back to being her. Your success, my success, only to boast to others and get a thrill out of demoralizing you and hoping that you'll quit and give in. That's something that I get a lot. Only pretty girls work in media. You didn't get the job because you're not pretty enough. You won't get the job in my lifetime, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you talk to us about this type of narcissism? Because the one that everyone knows about is the obsession with Instagram, you know, look at me, selfies, that sort of thing. But it's a more, I guess, inverted type of narcissism.
Yes, it's. You describe it well as being a bubble, and I suppose it's a bigger bubble does the narcissist need, and the Instagram people obviously need a worldwide bubble. But far more common is the family bubble and or the close acquaintances bubble. And it's like being queen of her own kingdom and everything has to be the way she wants it, arbitrarily. Like it doesn't make sense. And I know when I raised my son, we had a strict rule that, you know, if we told him not to do something or he had to do something, there was always a reason for it, a reason for his own, you know, for good functioning of life or for his own health or whatever. Mm. But if there was none of that when I was growing up, it was, you know, do it because I say so. Mm. And a lot of it didn't make sense because it makes sense now because I understand it was all about her. But for example, again, a very minor one, but quite a deep one as well. She wanted to keep her mother of the bride outfit a secret from me until the morning of my wedding. Exactly, you know, this kind of thing. But it's very small, really, but it was taken away from my chance to be, you know, the bride, for the centre of attention that way, on when it's appropriate for someone to be the centre of attention. They couldn't bear that. So that's why big occasions really trigger them, because especially something that's about somebody else, because to them that upsets the natural order of the universe when it should be about them.
Mm. Can you paint a picture for us, a family, a general, typical family dynamic, the mother, the narcissist, the father, the enabler, and another sibling as the golden child? You've got some great stuff on your website about that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, if that's okay, please.
Yeah, for some reason, the narcissistic mothers tend to... their thinking is not very nuanced. It's very childlike, and it's very black and white. And for some reason, many of them will pick one child to be the golden child, who can do no wrong and is spoiled rotten, and another child to be the scapegoat, who is everything is their fault. Mm-hmm. And they can do nothing right. And the narcissistic mother then plays favourites off these, you know, and it's horrible for the scapegoat because they're like, why can't I do nothing right and my sibling can? Mm. In many ways, being the scapegoat is the luck, relatively, I say in big inverted commas, luckier position, because at least they realise something is wrong. The golden child grows up very enmeshed with the narcissistic mother, and this only works for them as long as they are her total slave, basically. And it's very hard for them to get free in later life. So in a way, they're more trapped and to be pissed as well, because each thing is an absolute abuse and dysfunction, because you're not seeing the person as a person. Their mother is casting them in a role and forcing them into that role.
Yes.
And, you know, in reality, none of us are perfect and none of us are horrible. But, you know, in healthy relationships, you see the person as them. You don't see them as a label, but the narcissistic mothers, I suppose it's less work for them than having to see people, really. They do that. So it's very toxic. And what some narcissistic mothers do, they'll cast those roles from birth. But others will change. You can be the scapegoat one day and the golden child the next, depending how you're treating her. Or she might have wore the golden child thing as a bit of a reward to make the others try harder. Because it's very pleasant to see her approval and to be in her good books. And, you know, nature designed it that we would want our parents' approval.
Sure.
So it's a very powerful motivator. So some narcissistic mothers do that as manipulation as well. See, because, you know, the details of how each narcissistic mother acts can be different. But so some, as I say, have lifetime roles and others have changed the roles. But it's completely toxic either way, because it's never about seeing the child as an individual. It's about the mother's being the director of this play that she has going on her own head, really.
Well, from my perspective, I have a brother that at 30 cries when he loses a game on Xbox and then ditches it across the room. So he's got some issues in himself and he's the golden child. So,
well, there you go.
A little bit of aggression in there.
Where you have a kid and have your own career and are doing the things, you know, and it's been a harder path for you, but look how... what's your accomplishment compared to him then?
It's very bittersweet though, but yes. It brings me no joy, but yes.
No, I know. There's no winners in this dynamic.
And the enabler themselves, whether it's the dynamic of mother narcissist, father enabler, or the other way around, the enabler is also being abused. And these sort of people, you know, especially the older generation where they're taught to, you know, marriage is for life and that's it, sickness and in health. And particularly if you're a male, no matter where you are almost in the world, or at least in the Western society, it's a failure if you can't say that my wife beats me, or, you know, that my wife does this, that, the other. You'll never be believed. With me too, especially in a global sense.
Yeah. And you make a good point there, Emma, that we're speaking of narcissistic mothers, but I wrote about that because that was my experience. Mm. But, you know, it can be the narcissistic father, as you say, or it can be these dynamics come in very many shapes. We're just picking on one, but it's not saying it's the only one.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. The enabling father is abused in his turn, but I have less sympathy, and maybe that's me coming from my perspective, because they're adults, they could have stood up to her, and they abandoned their children completely in the service to this woman. Now, maybe not literally abandoned. My father said he didn't get physically abandoned as he lived with us all our lives and was a good provider and all the things. Mm. But any care or need or anything was subject to her whims. My father was as good a father as he could be once that condition was met, so that wasn't very good at all. So we were helpless children born into this situation, whereas my father, you know, and having said that, you know, given who he was and where he was from, had he a choice really? And that's one of the questions I think I'll never answer. But I find I'm very clear in my feelings about my mother, but my father, it's much more complex because, as you say, you know, was he a victim as well? Or was, you know, it's not as easy. It's not as straightforward.
Yes. Well, I've always thought to see it from the perspective is once you know something, once it's been told to you, you can't deny it anymore. Then it's up to you. For example, being in an emotionally abusive romantic relationship, I had no idea because I've grown up in this sort of dynamic, so dysfunction I see as normal. But then when, you know, your boss and your colleagues and your good friends are like, Emma, do not take this person back. It's not okay. You know, they keep treating you like crap. They obviously didn't know the extent of it because I wouldn't talk about it because I felt embarrassed. No one would believe me, all that sort of stuff. But then when they sit you down and say, you can't take them back this time, you've got to, you know, you've been brainwashed, basically, to be subservient for the most part. It takes some time. And once you hear the words, and in lots of other episodes in this podcast series, usually takes people lots of times to leave an abusive relationship. They try. And, you know, they might get sucked back in because they want this person, and especially parents, you want your parent to love you. You want, and so when, you know, they at a week or trying to bring you back in, they're like, we love you. What are you talking about? It's your fault. You're like, my God, it is my fault. Yeah. So in that sense, once you know and you've been told, and that was the big epiphany for me, like, you are in an emotionally abusive relationship. And I'm like, what is that? I don't know what you're talking about now. I Googled that term and saw my life story. And I realized, looking back, I also saw my family dynamic as well. Then once I knew, I couldn't deny it anymore. So to give some perspective on that question, they're looking at the enabler. Once the enabler has been told, and you can go about that however way you suit, you know, like gently or maybe through listening to a podcast series like now or sending a link of a thing. Once the enabler knows, and the enabler does know, they have to be accountable.
But people are very good at denial. In my experience, the neighbor makes sure that they never know.
You think? Okay.
Because, you see, because they, especially if it's a marriage partner, the narcissist will not put up with any insurrection. So to be successfully married to a narcissist, you have to play the game her way.
Mm-hmm.
It's her way or the highway is could be the narcissist motto. So by definition, if they're still in the marriage, they are playing the game her way. And they can't afford, again, I'm speaking in generalities, but they can't afford to see the truth because that would upheave everything. And so, you know, we tried to tell our father, we didn't use words like enabler or anything because we didn't know them, but and we didn't know the concepts, but, you know, specifically about his treatment of us. And I can't remember the example, but we must have had right on our side because he didn't answer it on its own merits. He just snapped at us. Stop making me unhappy with the wife I've chosen.
Right.
And that summed it up. Basically, I need to believe in this healthy relationship.
The narrative,
and everything that comes against that must be pushed away. Mm. So, yes, once you know it, and once you had your eyes open to your situation, but it's to get to that point. And as you said, you needed to be told quite a few times.
Mm.
You struggled to hear it as well. Understandably. I mean, this is not a character flaw. This is just human nature.
Yeah, yeah, because you want the best out of them because then they'll turn around, you know, and pull all sorts of stuff. Because, like, say your father did, or in my example, when my father even slightly stuck up for himself, he would be shut down. Or it'll be turned around that the whole world will find out that he's a bad person because she'll say this, and whatever it takes to, you know, bring him to his knees and continue the dynamic that's going on.
Exactly.
So,
they're in a situation, they're in a no-win situation in ways.
No. I wanted to talk about, we're at that stage now, I guess, because we're talking about turning points. For people, as we've just said, you'd be told numerous times, but there's that one bit where you're like, that's it. This is something wrong. This is not right. I had two turning points. I'll give you an example of the first one. So when you're a kid, you know nothing better. You're growing up like this, and I wasn't allowed sleepovers or anything like that. And I had a friend up the road, and my mother wasn't happy about that, but let that happen until behind the scenes she made sure that the families and people up the street had no interest in associating us two children together. But in high school, when you're starting to become an adult, you're starting to, you know, need to wear a bra or anything like that, which disgusted my mother, periods, all that sort of stuff, because I'm getting older and it's getting a lot harder to keep control of me. First turning point was when I got my first boyfriend when I was in late high school, year 10, 11, 12. And he was a family friend that I grew up with. I knew him since my birth. There's a video of me at 6 months old and him a year old playing toys.
Aww.
So my mother, my father, everyone, we all knew each other. You know that he's a good guy. But my mother hated the idea of it and was staunchly against it. So if I wrote to him, and one time I was writing to him. This was just when, you know, the ICQ and Merck and like the Facebook Messenger doesn't exist yet, or anything like Skype or that sort of stuff. But we're talking to each other and she pushed me off the computer, pushed me. And she had hit me before. This was just, you know, commonplace. Not my brother. No, he had never seen any of this sort of stuff. My father, yes, but not my brother. So this time, as opposed to, you know, just taking it, I'm getting older. I'm seeing that this is not right. I go to school. I don't hear anybody else saying that their parents, you know, do also this sort of stuff. I'm constantly excluded from stuff because I'm not allowed to go out to do it. I fight back. This time around, I push back. And we get into quite the, you know, leave me alone, the brawl. And my brother sees. So my brother comes in, and my mother is a demigod to my brother. And my father's come up, and he's, once again, you know, he knows what's going on. And this situation, when this happened, is now all my fault. And this was how I, quote, ruined the family, because what I actually did was stuck up for myself. But what my mother did was use reactive abuse, where she's like, see, you're the abuser. You're the terrible person. I've done nothing. And then you lash out. That was a turning point for me, and I think a great example to give to get your thoughts on reactive abuse, because that is, let's call it a tool that a narcissist relies on to, you know, get you to that point that you do snap back, because that validates that what they've been doing to you is
you're the bully.
Yes.
And absolutely. I couldn't really add to what you've done. You've described it so well that they're brilliant to create no-win situations. So either you put up with that treatment, or if you react to it, then you're the worst in the world. That's where my mother, for example, would have ended up in floods of tears, and my father would have come to her defence. And what are you doing to your mother? Why are you making your mother cry? And your mother then obviously did what she did. And in a way, they sound so plausible, because in their world, you have abused them.
Absolutely,
because by definition, by standing up to them, that is abuse to them, because they should get everything the way they want it. So any minor way that they are thwarted is the biggest cruelty ever. So they sound very sincere, because they are. And then you end up the bad guy, and of course all the relationships are very toxic and unhealthy in the family. All the dynamics are bad. So your brother and your father will be agreeing with her that you're the bad guy. And it takes a lot of strength of character to realise that you're not, but to hang on, I was just kind of stop her pushing me off the computer. Because it's very hard when everybody's telling you you're the problem. And especially since one of the issues we have with our mothers is that they won't believe reality. But then if everybody's telling us we're the problem, are we disbelieving reality to stand up against that? So are we being like her? And so that's a bit of a flaw. Well, not a flaw, but a bad dynamic as well in our own thoughts, because we're trying to be fair, but yet we can't even agree on what reality is in this mixed-up family.
No. And so once you've stand up for yourself, where do you go from there? So I live with my grandparents for a while, and my dad would guilt me into just try with your mother, and she would be nice as pie for a couple of days, and as soon as, she's got back in, so she thinks, we're back on, and the abuse and the bullying and the just being terrible. And my brother is used as some sort of like bouncer against me, and he takes great pleasure in it, just like her. And it got to a point where, for myself, I think I was 25, and my dad convinced me that I should come back and just stay for a little while, and it'll be all sorts of good. And I did. And they were just the two of them. Neither, my mother doesn't work. My brother was too good for that at the time, just partying and all that sort of stuff. And I've never been a partier, so I'm very studious. I'm very, working hard in my profession. I was going to work, and I was standing at the train station, and I just thought, if I just jump out, it will be over. So I rang my dad, and I just said, Dad, seriously? For goodness sake, could you please, because and that's where I was rounded back to, the thing, maybe not to the extent, because he's not there all day to see, as a child, because my father worked and my mother stayed home to look after us, quote unquote. And that was the only time that my father, whatever he did, because I wasn't there for it, and I came back that day and everybody was super nice. It only lasted a little while, but they were sorry and super nice. So right. I could have easily just done it, you know what I mean? And yeah, other people yeah. in our situations sadly have done it.
Yep, yep.
So talking
because it feels like there's no way out because no. they have such a web around us. Yeah, totally.
And so that's, I guess, the fear of like one, talking about it to a counsellor or something like that, because talking about it makes it real. And then two, standing up for yourself, you get in that situation that I was in where I'm surrounded. Like there's no way out. All my relatives don't want anything to do with the family because they just cannot deal with my mother. And that's all somehow my fault, even though I have no life, no interaction with them at all. But somehow I've told them as a 5-year-old or whatever, which I haven't, you know. So... and I consistently hear about that, that I've like rung people and told them, I'm like, I don't even know where they are or what their number is. I don't know my relatives because of you.
Yeah.
Talk to me, about turning points and maybe your experience on that, because sometimes some people, you know, you have to cut ties. And in my situation, I've done it. I've cut ties. I have nothing to do with them. Do not talk to me because it will never get any better. No matter what I do, I cannot please this person. I've tried everything to the point that it makes me physically ill. No more. But some other people can still have a little bit of a relationship. Just your thoughts on that, please.
Yes. The one part of my work that I take very seriously, I feel that we need to put it into the public domain that it's okay not to have a relationship with your parents. My turning point was, I can give you the details in a minute if you want, but basically somebody gave me permission. A friend witnessed what they were like, and it wasn't even the worst they'd be like. And she said, oh my God, I know you said all along it wasn't easy, but this was horrendous. I had no idea. And I was, well, that wasn't too bad by our standards. when I had been successful that we negotiated the rapids quite well, she was like, oh my God, that was a shipwreck. And in a way, she told me in plain words, yes, this is not right. And that was the permission I needed to cut off contact, and I did at that point. And I want everybody to know that it's okay to cut off contact with abusive parents. You wouldn't be expected to stay with an abusive partner the way we used to. I never advocate cutting off contact because I don't think that's my place. I think everybody's situation is different and they have to make their own decisions for themselves. And also, you know, part of the toxic dynamic is that the people are being disempowered, and I'm certainly not going to take over by exerting my power, i.e. my opinion on them. So I want to empower them for them rather than take any power to me. So I never advocate no contact, but I really, really, really want people to know that they're allowed, that it's a possibility.
Absolutely. Do you mind telling us your turning point? Because now I'm slightly curious.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's basically my parents, it was the wedding anniversary, and my father rang and said, can we come to your part of the world? We lived about an hour and a half away from them. For me, will you book a restaurant? And again, you normalise the abnormal. I remember having a conversation with my husband saying, we have to pick a restaurant that we like well enough to go to, but we don't like so much that we'd be devastated if we never get to go back, because we didn't know what they'd be like, you know?
Yeah.
And really, just even having that conversation. So I had said to my father, a friend of mine was staying with me that weekend, she'd have to come. And he said, oh, that's fine. So we turned up, and they were their usual horrible selves. They had just come back from holiday, and they honestly didn't draw breath about this bloody holiday, didn't talk to anybody, ignored everybody. We're at this meal, and next thing, my son was then 12 and hadn't wanted to come, and I'd be like, to my regret, was like, yeah, it's your grandparents' wedding anniversary, and it was a special one as well, one with a zero at the end. You have to come. And so he's kind of drooping at the table, being ignored. And after a little while, he said, go on out to the car. And he ran. And next thing, my friend was being ignored. And at one time, she tried to interject into the conversation with a question. My mother glared at her as if, like, what are you doing interrupting me? And she, in the end, she said, excuse me, and left. And she joined my son in the car. And she'd been saying to him, oh, my God, your poor mother. I never realised. But it was like a murder mystery game. People were disappearing from this table. And still my parents had just rabbit on. There was no... My mother did say, where's she gone? Like, she didn't even use my friend's name. Is she gone out for cigarettes? And I said, yeah, maybe. And my mother screwed up her face. She disapproved of smoking. And how I didn't go across the table at her in that moment. I just... Yeah. But anyway, so my friend never came back. Yeah, and I just listened to her go on about every detail of her holiday. We got to hear about it nearly in real time. And we were there for 2 hours and 45 minutes. And apart from ordering food kind of conversation with the waiters, they just talked nonstop. It was just... And that would be standard. You know, we had met with my sister, who was also there, an hour or 2 hours before the meal. So we'd have time with her because we knew we'd get no time with her at the meal because it'd be all about my parents. And it was.
Yeah.
So that was the turning point, and I realised then I didn't want anything to do with them, but then I was terrified of breaking the news to them. So for about 2 weeks, I was just ill with nerves and not knowing how to react to what I tell them, what I not, what I... Well, so 2 weeks later to the day, my father rang and said, oh, we'd such a nice time at that restaurant. We'd like to go again. Will we go today? And I said, I really don't want to see you. And he said, why not? And he knew, like, he'd rung. It was a bit of a subterfuge. And I said, honest, the last one was such an ordeal. I don't want to repeat it. And he said, why was it an ordeal? And as I tried to tell them, out came the abuse. Well, you think you're so perfect. We put up with you and you're a horrible person. Mm-hmm. And you dare comment on our little foibles. And we didn't want your friend there anyway. And, you know, and I was saying that they never spoke to my son. Well, your son doesn't speak to us. You know? And, it just basically abuse. And then my mother got on and she was like, I have to go for an operation, you're being mean to me. And I was going, well, you rang me, I didn't ring you. And it was awful. But I didn't see either of them for 10 years after that. My mother has since died and I have reconnected with my father because he is in need of care and I have stepped up. But I'd have been happy not to see him ever either, but there you go. So yeah, that's my turning point. And I was 45 or something, 40 something anyway. And I'm thinking, honestly, I'm disgusted with myself that it took me this long. And if somebody had given me permission years ago, because I struggled with a relationship all my life. And I regret inflicting it on my son and my husband all that, you know. If somebody had given me permission, I would have been gone long since. But I thought you have to keep in touch.
That's... Seriously, yeah. To use the example of ripping the Band-Aid off, that's a hell of a Band-Aid that you had to rip off and get done. But you did it, and you're all the better for it. And I guess it's a very... I don't even know the word that you would use to describe it, but I guess, well, to a degree at peace, because it's finally over. It's no pleasure, but it's just like silent... but for myself, I was worried, and I had that struggle, as we've discussed before, about the enabler feeling sorry for them, but maybe not, because the enabler had the responsibility of looking after me, and it's very debatable, exactly as what you said. But for me, the turning point where I said, no, that's it, I'm done, I struggled with it too. I am a 35-year-old girl whose parents have never rung me once, never. Actually, there might be one or two, and that's only when, you know, I don't call for a week and they will ring but hang up because they're too cheap to give me a phone call. They'll call my brother any old time, but not for me. They won't pay for a phone call for me. So you can look through if someone could be bothered. Yeah. They've never rang me. I always have to ring them, and if I don't, I will get their wrath. Yeah. So they want to know why.
It's pure bullying.
Yeah, and we live in different sides of the country for a reason. Yeah. I had said... to them, you know, like, you guys never call this, that, the other. And they're like, come over and visit us. And I've said, no, I don't. And I was trying. And I privately spoken to my dad that, you know, I can't deal with this. I'm sick of being treated like crap. I know that I don't deserve it, but I'm doing it to try and help you. But at to what cost? And, you know, my dad's like, well, you just be nicer, you know, this, that, the other. And he'd just... And silent, and he would, you know, be under the influence at all times because that's how he gets through. So one day they came over here unannounced. I told them not to. I was busy at work, genuinely. Do not have time for this. And they came over. And as like always, the first 2 days are really good, very demanding, very like under the breath, like, why is that on the wall? And I'd had through the years, anytime my mother will come here, give her a great example, she'll pick something, anything in the room that she doesn't like. That candelabra hanging on the wall that's got little, you know, tea light candles, that's going to fall. I say, that's been hanging there for 2 years. That's not going to fall.
Yeah.
That's going to fall. No, it's not. Yeah. Seriously, for 2 years, it's fine. I will come back home from work. That is fallen to the ground. / you can see that someone has ripped it. And I'm told that my thing broke. And if I had only listened to her, that wouldn't have fallen. So that's it. So you never want her to come. So that was the worry one. I took all my pets and I had them at work because I was worried that she would hurt them, because that's another story that I can't bring myself to talk about out loud. But in the situation here, she got mad because I wanted to take a day off to spend time with them. And I'd said that I hadn't seen my father for 2 years and I really want to spend time with them. And a person here in my management said, Emma, my father died because I was so busy with work that I didn't get to spend enough time with him. And I really want you to do that because I think it's important. But because he didn't mention my mother, because, you know, he was just having his father died, is irrelevant.
Yeah.
He didn't mention he had a brother or a sister or an aunt or an uncle as well, but he didn't mention my mother. And I touched by the fact that, you know, in such a busy time of year, that he has given me the opportunity to have the day off, read that message out loud to my dad because he was in the room, not my mother because she wasn't, you know, because we were having the conversation. But that was... some sort of extreme insult. And so she went into some sort of, I guess, like spiral of just total anger. And you can see it in her eyes and be quiet about stuff. I'm like, we're going to go here. Okay. And we're going to do this. Okay. And you can see it building, brewing. I'm like, my God. Yeah. And so I would ignore it. And my father would ignore it because it's ridiculous. And we keep going, and then Dad's like, would you please do something nice to your mother? I'm like, what? It's ridiculous to, and we've talked about this in this podcast series, you know, having to pander to these unreasonable. completely unreasonable. And in any logical, sane sense, you wouldn't even, you have to. It's acknowledging it is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So... then they had a hire car that wanted, I wanted to show them this beautiful waterfall, and you'd have to drive through a small lake that wouldn't even go up to, you know, the, what's it, the things that you turn on the car, the, on the wheels, the bolts on the wheels. So not very high at all, but nonetheless, and you saw normal cars drive through it, but we had a four-wheel drive. She screamed and yelled that the car was going to, you know, this, that, the other, and we're going to wreck the car, and it's going to cost us so much money, and it's the worst, like literally screamed like she was being murdered, and it was the worst time ever. But the car got through because even a normal car would get through. So then she didn't like that either because it didn't work, and it was just like leading up to some point of horror. So for my wonderful day off that, you know, my boss said this was the day now, the next day, my father said that she didn't sleep all night. Sometimes she will come in and she'll just stare at me or put her head down right close to check that I'm breathing, which is really disconcerting. But then the morning and I woke up and I'm like, okay, well, let's go see this before the thunderstorm. It'll be great. You know, I've got this day off. Let's get the most out of it. She flipped out and said that she's leaving and that she's clearly, I don't love her or want her because I just want to be with my dad. I'm like, I am so sick of this. And so I stuck up for myself.
Yeah.
And my father, she's like, you've done this. And I'm like, this is the reason why, you know, nobody wants anything to do with you. She's like, I knew it. You've called my relatives and this. I'm like, I haven't done anything to anyone. I don't.
Yeah.
You do not live rent free in my mind anymore. Only because my dad makes it happen. I don't care. All I am interested in is helping myself and other people get away from people like you. I'm done.
Wow.
If you want to leave. Yes, I'm done. Yeah. If you want to leave, you're not coming back.
Good.
And she left. And then my father's like, now look what you've done. No, and young, could you have her back? No, you're not having her back, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I haven't done any of this. All I've done is said, I'm done with you both. And then I called my brother to try and tell my brother, you know, this is what happened. Of course, he just lashed out and threatened to come over here and bash me. And I had said to him that if he does it again, I will call the police. Because this has happened before, but if you ask him, it will be a totally different story. And then I said to my father and my brother that I am not speaking to her anymore, just so you know. I don't want anything to do with her because at least we can all come to the agreement that nothing I do makes her happy. So why do I have to... Why? I am the one that's so let's entertain that scenario. I am so horrible. So why do I have to keep putting up with this then? And that's where I've been since. And it's, I don't even know. But I want nothing to do with them. And I can't tell you enough to know how much my life is better and my confidence and my personal and professional life and everything that I've done since. Just incredible difference, because I've lost that ball and chain of being accountable to someone that's never going to be happy. If my podcast series of this has done really well, it's had 20,000 listens just on iTunes.
Oh, wow.
My mother would not be proud of that. You know, or she would say she was, but it'd be like you've coined perfectly on your website. You know, they're not happy at all, or like that. It's a very backhanded celebration, if you even get that.
Yeah. Oh no, God forbid they celebrate your success. And how long ago was that happened, Emma? How long are you free?
December last year, 2018.
Oh, right. So quite recently then, and you can already see the difference in your life.
Oh, just my skin was covered in and my health. And my happiness at work and feeling self-assured, and I still have, you know, it's years of abuse. And as the counsellor said, it will take you some time. But doing things like this helps people as well, because, gosh, I had spoken to other people in this podcast series, and it may not be in the actual series itself, but they said to me, you know, it's good that you worked it out at, 35, you could have worked it out at 65. You know, there's some people who have worked it out at 75. It doesn't matter when, it's just as long as you've done it.
Yeah. The most heartbreaking emails I get are from the 70-year-olds whose mother is 90 and still alive and still abusing them, and they're realising it now, but they're like, you know, they're 70. That's the reality. It's heartbreaking, And so I regret that it took me to 45 or whatever I was, but it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, well, I regret that it took to 35, but I guess it was because I just so desperately wanted, and I didn't know anything different, because sometimes, you know, but when you're so busy and everyone around you that you care about has no interest in actually looking after you at all, not because you've done anything, it's just because they've chosen it, chosen you to be that, maybe because you are confident and they're not, because you are living the life that they wish that they could have done but chose not to, and then that's somehow your fault. It's not an easy thing to talk about, but something that has to be spoken about, because it could help that doesn't understand or couldn't even fathom. Because it wasn't easy. And listening to your story, and if anyone goes to your wonderful website and reads it for themselves, it's not a walk in the park, especially when you do that first turning point when you're like, actually, no, but it's worth it.
It's true. It's none of it's easy. And it's not easy to write about. And but the point is that it's about telling the truth so other people, hopefully, as you say, the other you and the other me, won't have to wait till later in their life. I love it like that when 20-year-olds write to me and say, oh, I just realised. I go, yes, you go, girl. You know, you're the whole of your life now.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting what you're saying about your skin. You wouldn't be the first person who said that to me. And what I think people don't realise, we use the word toxic nearly as a metaphor. But no, it's real. Toxic equals poison. And that situation is poisonous to us. And it reflects on our bodies as well as our minds and our emotions. So we are constantly giving ourselves low-grade poison to be in touch with them. And, of course, that's going to impact on absolutely everything else in our lives. Mm. How can it not?
Absolutely.
But sometimes when that's all you know, you don't know any better. So it's only when you're free for the first time that you get to say, oh, so this is what life could be like. Mm. You didn't know any. Again, we've had it since birth. So you don't know any better until you do.
Yeah, and it's such a shame that there's so many people out there that feel that. And now I, for a lack of a better word, get triggered when I see, you know, a relationship or even on TV where I see, well, let's use a scenario, but it goes both ways, a woman being treated really badly by a man, or really, really upset me at a shop where you see a mother that clearly doesn't care about their child, because I see myself in that child, and that just... it's not okay. How do you reconcile in your head and make peace with the situation? Your mother has passed on now. Is there any suggestion or advice that you can give to people that listening to this podcast could be in the situation of they know something's up, they have almost confirmed it in their head, but they can't, you know, bring themselves to say, all right, let's take action, but listening to this is they clearly want to, or maybe that they've done it and they're just desperately listening and trying to absorb as much as they can to get to that point of peace. Is there anything that you can offer as a suggestion?
The one thing I in common with many people is that they feel guilty. They feel guilty to leave, or if they leave, they feel guilty and that spoils their experience of having left. And the one thing I love to say to people is that guilt is real, but it's not true. Mm. Because what it is your mind, your body trying to help you do the right thing, but it has wrong information. And the information it has is you have to stay with an abuser if they're related to you. And that's wrong information. So when they feel the guilt, just to speak to the guilt, to observe the guilt, so that they know it's something they're experiencing rather than something that is, that makes sense, that they can say, hello, guilt, yes, I hear you, but actually you've got wrong information. This is the right thing to do. I don't want to say not to let the guilt stop them, because, again, I don't want to be telling people what to do.
Absolutely.
But, again, to realise that guilt is natural, but it's not appropriate. It's not true to the situation. Because nobody walks away on a whim. You know, nobody walks away the minute their mother, you know, is 10 minutes late with their birthday card or something.
No.
You know, this is after a lifetime of abuse and a lifetime of trying to fix it and a lifetime of trying to get through to her about what's wrong and a lifetime of wounds and pain and tears and limitations. So nobody does this on a whim. It takes a lot to do it. And if you get to that stage, it obviously is the right thing, and not to be, you know, I won't say not to be second guessing yourself, because you will, but also not to believe the second guessing, because it's just programmed thoughts rather than reality. And the other thing about people often say is, but what if she dies? If I go no contact, what if she dies? And the reality is, she will die. We all will die. So there you go. So if you are no contact and you mean that forever, your mother will die in your absence. And that is something a lot of people really struggle with. And I suppose the sooner they can get round to getting their head around that, the better, because that is a reality that they are signing up for if they go no contact. To my mind, it was easier because I didn't have that big thing about her dying. And when she did die and I heard, I was very shocked, all right. But I wasn't bereaved. I'd had my bereavement already.
She had died for you a long time ago.
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't have wished ill on her, and I never did either of them any bad. But I certainly didn't have to hang around and be the punching bag myself. Mm. And to me, it was, if she experienced the loss of me, that was natural consequences. And we don't have to protect abusers from the consequences of their own abuse. Mm. You know, and I'm sure it hurt her. And I'm sure, although she had a narrative, you know, to explain it, that didn't, that excused her. Like,
So will mine.
So then she could play the victim. Yeah, she could play the victim. And why is she done? You know, and I'm sure the way I describe it is she lost her chew toy. It wasn't me, Danu, that she missed per se as a person, but it was this image of the daughter, and it was all her story that she was telling herself. But, you know, and I didn't wish that on her, but it was the price of me or her, and I chose me. And especially when she was the one insisting on the price, it could have been, you know, we both could have been happy. You know, in a good relationship, you don't have to choose between you and the other person, because your relationship enhances you both. So she was the one forcing the situation and expecting me to pay the price of her whims and her selfishness. And I eventually, as we've discussed, chose, realised, not doing that anymore. So to me, there's no need for guilt. And if, as she did, die afterwards without me ever having seen her again, that, you know, it's sad. It's a pity it had to be that way, but it wasn't my doing. It was her having the consequences of all her actions.
And you can't change these people unless they want to change. I've discussed this with many psychologists in this podcast series. It's possible that they can change, but they've got to genuinely want to. And because they're such master manipulators, you have no idea whether that they're actually giving it a go. Speaking of making peace with it and guilt trips, how do you have any advice in combating it from your father or the golden child, or even, you know, peers that may not know you that well, you know, what do you call it, acquaintances in the workplace, where they're like, but she's your mother, and they've grown up in some sort of Brady Bunch situation of, you know, happiness, and they wouldn't have a clue what it could be like. And maybe they, you know, because something that I did, which is funny because my brother's like, I bet she didn't have her be seen by anyone and this, that, the other. I made her meet everybody and my managers, and I put this big effort into, you know, this, that, the other. Nobody did, but someone could say, oh, I saw her and she was very friendly, this, that, the other. It's all your fault. And it almost, like some people, especially children, we've talked about this in the podcast series, will be afraid that if they say anything that they'll only have the parent side validated because, you know, well, it's the mother. And as we've talked about, the mother is seen as some sort of godlike thing in our society at the moment.
Okay, well, there's two distinct questions there. One is, what do you say to the rest of the family? Most often in practice, you cannot have a relationship. If you cut off contact with your mother, you cannot have a relationship with your enabling father and possibly with your siblings, because they will side with her and she will insist that they choose. You might not, but she will. Yeah. If you're talking to her, you're not talking to me. To the extent relationships can work, I always advise that people say, we'll have a relationship independent of her. We won't talk about her. And the narcissistic mothers are very good at a thing called flying monkeys, where they say to the person in touch, tell her how much I miss her, or tell her that, you know, and that you get these messages back, or you get, because the narcissistic mother is giving this flying monkey such a horrible time, the flying monkey is desperate to get back to the status quo, and they'll come out with, oh, she's so sad, please help her, or the classic, be the bigger person, right?
Yes.
But the way to preempt that is to say very clearly and very kindly, we are not discussing her. We will talk about your football and my tennis and, you know, all the things in our lives that friends talk about. We are not discussing her. And that's very hard. They'll try and you say, no, do you remember we weren't going to discuss her? Now, whether they will accept those conditions or not, because they're still in the toxicity, they probably won't. But to me, that's the only way sanity can prevail. Because if you are listening to talk about her and messages from her, you are still in that web and that you've no freedom. So do know that if you cut off contact with your narcissistic mother, there is a very real chance you'll be losing more members of the family as well on that basis. And that's, again, a horrible reality, but that is. As for friends and acquaintances, it's hard to give a one-size-fits-all answer because, as you say, you know, you have different relationships and different dynamics with each person. And as you say, people have their beliefs. I'm torn on that one, and I never came up with a good answer, because part of me says, not your job to educate them. The trick is then to avoid, deflect. Like, if you go home to your family for Christmas, you could just say, I went skiing for Christmas or whatever, and not just talk about it. On the other hand, I do think that it's good to educate people, and that more people know that this kind of toxicity and this kind of abuse occurs, the best for everybody. We're paving the way for the ones coming after us. But is that our job when we're wounded and hurting anyway? And I suspect it's not. So I can absolutely see both sides of explain it to them or don't explain it to them. I don't know which is the one to go for. So I think each person has to make up their mind. But I think, don't overshare. Don't put yourself in a position where other people can judge you, to the extent you can avoid that, because it's none of their business and they don't realise. And unless you're willing to educate them and they're willing to hear, you know, don't put yourself in a position where people can just make sweeping judgments of you. So to the extent you can deflect, the better, I think.
Excellent. That's really sage advice. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
If there's anything else that you want to add that we didn't, like your website is a plethora of information. So if there's any other nugget of advice that you've got, I'd love to hear from that. But besides that, question wise, I'm done. But yeah, if there's anything else, your book as well is very. I love the name. The name is fantastic.
Yeah.
Is there anything
else?
It
took a while to come up with a name, and the reason we did is because most people who contacted me. Because the thing is that narcissistic mothers, two levels of abuse. There's the original abuse, and then there's the lying about it, and that's the head abuse, that never happened, or you're oversensitive, or you can't take a joke, or whatever they particular trick they use. So, and so many of us believe that we're crazy because reality is telling us one thing, but our mother is telling us another. So when people realise the truth, the biggest takeaway they have, or the first biggest one is, oh, I'm not crazy. It wasn't me. It was her all along. And that's why the title of the book, You're Not Crazy, It's Your Mother. And my website, yes, is daughtersofnarcissisticmothers.com. And I have a newsletter that people can sign up for, which people are kind enough to say they get great value from. So I would invite people to do that. The other advice, the main takeaway I would say to people is, one of the biggest lies the narcissist mother tells us is that it's our job or our responsibility to keep her happy, and it's really not. And the more we can allow her to be unhappy, the more freedom we have. Because she puts her, there was a classic example, if you don't make me happy, I will literally kill myself. Now, she wasn't going to, I'm sure,
but narcissists will never do that. Yeah.
So she was putting so much of her responsibility for her literal life onto you doing what you were supposed to do. And, you know, at the end of the day, they all do that to a greater or lesser extent. You know, my mother was, if you won't make me happy, I'll cry. And then, you know, so the threats were less extreme, but the manipulation was the same. So I wish I'd known years ago, crying, that's okay. Or sit in the middle of the road, that's okay. Because it's not our job to keep her happy. It's our job to act with integrity and to be decent and all those things. But that doesn't mean playing somebody else's game or giving into somebody else's manipulations. So the willingness to let her be unhappy, which I know is against everything she taught us all our lives, and I know that's huge, but there's power in that, and I'd love people to know that too.
That was episode 2 of the second series of Emotional Abuse, A Conversation, chatting with Danu Morrigan, who runs the website Daughters of Narcissistic Mothers and author of You're Not Crazy, It's Your Mother. This episode discussed emotional abuse when it comes from family members. To hear the rest of this series and series 1, which delves into emotionally abusive romantic relationships, Google Emotional Abuse, A Conversation, or check out both series on iTunes.